Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Chris Lehman, D.C. Bureau Chief with The Nation magazine, who takes a critical look at the distorted and often sanitized corporate media coverage of Donald Trump and his campaign infused with hate and fear. David Knoll, professor of law and co-author of the new book, Vigilante Nation, How State-Sponsored Terror Threatens Our Democracy, who talks about the state-based GOP MAGA strategy to roll back civil, political, and privacy rights. And Kika Matos, president of the National Immigration Law Center, who assesses the danger of Donald Trump's demonization of immigrants while worrying about the Democrats' increasingly harsh position on immigration. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Russia's war in Ukraine, now in its third year, has upended the balance of power in the Caucasus and Central Asia. As the nations in the region grow more nervous about Russia, Turkey is promoting a new powerful alliance, the Organization of Turkic States, or OTS, which is focused on expanding regional cooperation on social, economic, trade, and foreign policy. The Turkic world spans Europe and Asia, covering Turkey, Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan. It spills into Russia with its many Turkic minorities and China, home to 12 million Uyghurs. The idea of a common Turkic identity, a boogeyman for the Soviets and for today's Russia and China, is flourishing. According to The Economist magazine, Turkey has cashed in on the region's desire to reduce dependence on Russian arms. Azerbaijan used Turkish-made drones to devastating effect in its brief war with Armenia in 2020. Military officers from OTS countries are flocking to Turkey for training, while Turkish military advisors are training soldiers in former Soviet states. As Americans are casting their ballots in early voting, it's clear that this year's presidential election won't be decided by a margin of millions of votes, but likely by thousands in the seven tightly contested states of Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. After Donald Trump's big lie that the 2020 election was stolen from him, followed by the violent January 6th insurrection, the twice-impeached former president's Republican allies and election deniers have passed a barrage of laws in GOP-controlled states that have dramatically restricted voting access. However, in states controlled by Democrats, ballot access has been made easier with the expansion of early voting, mail-in ballots, and no-excuse absentee voting. Hannah Ford, director of All Voting Is Local Project, told State's Newsroom, "The last 4 years have been a long, strange trip. Rollbacks were almost exclusively tied to Trump's big lie." According to the Voting Rights Lab, nearly 6,500 bills were introduced since 2021 to change the voting process, and hundreds of those bills were enacted. Votes determining which party will control the House of Representatives after November's election could run through the Hudson Valley and rural upstate New York. 2 years ago, Republicans flipped 4 seats in liberal New York districts where Joe Biden had soundly defeated Donald Trump in 2020. This year, progressives and Democratic activists are determined to win back congressional seats on Long Island and upstate New York. They've been building an energized Get Out the Vote operation focusing on communities of color. As of early October, volunteers had knocked on 400,000 doors and registered over 20,000 new voters. But in an intense battle being waged by expensive TV ads for control of the House, turnout is far from certain. The Atlantic reports that Democrats are hoping that the enthusiasm generated by Kamala Harris will help them reverse Republican wins in the Empire State 2 years ago. New York Governor Kathy Hochul's victory that year was so underwhelming, she won by fewer than 7 points, that former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi blamed her performance for costing Democrats control of the House. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
In a recent article for The Nation magazine, Chris Lehman recounts how U.S. corporate media has, since 2016, played down and softened Donald Trump's racist and authoritarian rhetoric, often attributing his words to claims that it was said as a joke, an exaggeration to get attention, or to own the libs. But Lehman points out that during Trump's 4 years as president, he followed through on implementing some of the nation's most bigoted and odious policies, such as the infamous Muslim ban, revealing the failure of mainstream media to responsibly inform readers and viewers about Trump's malevolent beliefs. In the closing days of the 2024 campaign, Trump's New York City Madison Square Garden rally didn't disappoint critics who had predicted that the former disgraced president and his sycophants would reenact the 1939 pro-Nazi rally, also held at the Garden 85 years earlier. The rally featured speaker after speaker, echoing Trump's racist, xenophobic, and misogynist worldview, with one so-called comedian declaring that Puerto Rico was a garbage island. While media coverage of Trump's repugnant language over the years has often substituted benign euphemisms for actual reporting, this time, most media accurately conveyed the rally's hateful vibe. The fact that the billionaire owners of the Washington Post and Los Angeles Times refused to endorse a presidential candidate in this year's election is one more sign of how Trump is succeeding in intimidating the nation's press. Your reporter spoke with Chris Lehman, the nation's D.C. bureau chief, about his article titled, "The Press Needs to Start Taking Trump Literally," where he takes a critical look at the distorted and often sanitized coverage of Donald Trump and his campaign infused with hate and fear.
There has been this, you know, very, I think, disastrous, self-consciously distancing effect that mainstream political reporters have adopted in covering the Trump phenomenon. All during the sort of 2016 GOP primary cycle, they treated him as largely as a joke, a novelty, a reality TV spectacle. That was sort of when this corrosive process of not taking what he said seriously started to sink in. And famously, this right-wing columnist, Selena Zito, put forward the diktat to journalists and voters generally that they should be taking Trump seriously, but not literally. Selena Zito now is an abject Trump toady who literally sort of suggested that God intervened to save Trump's life at the Butler, Pennsylvania assassination attempt. So that's where taking Trump seriously but not literally gets you, in my view. You know, you're suspending your critical faculties and you're doing a profound disservice to the public interest, which is easy to forget in these debauched days, but that is what the press is there for. If you're downplaying an authoritarian threat, you're normalizing authoritarian conduct. And we saw this right out of the gate in Trump's first administration, not only with things like the Muslim ban, but people forget these things in part because the political press has the attention span of a gnat. But Trump immediately created a federal agency to document the alleged wave of undocumented immigrant violent crime, even though objectively, there has never been any such wave. Undocumented immigrants commit such crimes at a rate significantly lower than the native population. This, I would argue, was also an early tell that Trump was, in fact, a fascist, because that is what fascists do. They create the myth of sort of irredeemable group traits to target minorities and persecute them. He also established very early on, appointed Chris Kobach to head a presidential commission on rampant election fraud, of which there was none. And the commission eventually disbanded in shame, but it's the same pattern. And, you know, I do feel this far, going on 10 years into the Trump era, for journalists to be continuing to adopt this pose, to quote Zoolander, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. Like, there is absolutely no excuse for this kind of malpractice among political journalists.
I wanted to refer to one of your recent articles titled The Washington Post Craven Capitulation to the Billionaire Class. The billionaire owners of The Washington Post, Jeff Bezos and Patrick Soon-Shiong, who owns the LA Times, they declined to endorse a presidential candidate in this year's election, owing, according to many, of their fear of retribution if Trump is elected. And to many, this is dangerous. It's alarming in that it's really what professor of philosophy Jason Stanley, who wrote the book How Fascism Works, and he describes this act as anticipatory obedience in his study of fascism, which is precisely what these two owners of these major newspapers did.
Absolutely. And one thing that is especially appalling about the Post doing this is, of course, the Post, you know, deserved reputation as a hard-hitting and impartial investigative paper is founded on its reportage of Watergate, which was about a power-mad authoritarian Republican president who defied, you know, constitutional order, broke the law, tried to weaponize the executive branch to punish his political enemies. All these acts Donald Trump has committed to the nth power in comparison to Nixon. And for the Post to be taking this stand or this non-stand rather of pretending that an endorsement doesn't matter, which is, I guess, Jeff Bezos just published a column defending his decision saying that endorsements don't matter. You know, I'm tired of this phony jadedness in both the pundit class and the billionaire class. You can say all kinds of things don't matter, but you own the platform, Mr. Billionaire, and you own the public responsibility that goes with that. He did not dodge an endorsement in the 2020 race. In fact, he, according to Marty Baron's book, Bezos said, why wouldn't we endorse? The question still holds today, especially amid all the obvious factors we've been discussing, the clear mental deterioration of Trump, Trump's further descent into overt fascism, the consolidation of a very motivated anti-democratic governing elite behind Project 2025. This, of all cycles, is not one to sit out if you're a newspaper that's serious about your public responsibility. And what Jeff Bezos has told his readers is that he's not serious about their responsibility. And as a result, 200,000 readers have canceled their subscriptions to the Washington Post. Unfortunately, that will, of course, won't make a dent in the oceanic fortune of Jeff Bezos and could hurt the, you know, people who are doing good work at the Washington Post. I think, you know, if you're going to boycott Bezos, which I totally support, you should hit him where it hurts in his Amazon Prime account.
That was Chris Layman, D.C. bureau chief with The Nation magazine and a contributing editor at The Baffler. Find a link to his recent Nation article, The Press Needs to Start Taking Trump Literally, and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After the U.S. Supreme Court overturned 50 years of precedent in June 2022, eliminating women's reproductive rights under the court's 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling, 21 states now ban abortion or restrict the procedure, with 10 of those states having no exception for pregnancies resulting from rape or incest. Many of those same states under Republican Party control have legislated statewide book bans, censored the teaching of America's slave-era history, criminalized teachers who discuss LGBTQ issues in the classroom, and erased all references to climate change from state law. Since Donald Trump incited the January 6th violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol to overturn the results of the 2020 election, the nation has witnessed a resurgence of legal vigilantism in extremist-led red states. The new book, Vigilante Nation, How State-Sponsored Terror Threatens Our Democracy, written by David Null, professor of law at Rutgers University,
and UCLA professor of law John Michaels, documents the overlapping networks of right-wing lawyers, politicians, plutocrats, and white Christian nationalist preachers that have resurrected state-supported vigilantism. Your reporter spoke with Vigilante Nation co-author Professor Knoll, who examines the MAGA Republican strategy to roll back civil, political, and privacy rights and subvert American democracy.
You know, our book argues that MAGA politicians and lawyers have cultivated a network of vigilantes to help them secure political power and enforce an illiberal cultural agenda. And the network extends from everyone from individuals who are getting books banned to parents who police which bathrooms high school kids use to sort of armed militiamen who appeared at ballot drop boxes in 2022 and are likely going to show up on Election Day this year. And, you know, our thesis is that particularly since the January 6th insurrection, there has been an effort to legalize vigilante activity and give it the cover of law. When you say vigilante, people tend to think of private actors like the Klan, or if you're thinking about Hollywood movies, figures like Batman. And the pop culture image of a vigilante is somebody who operates completely independently of the state with no legal authority. But when you dig into U.S. history, there's this alternative tradition of vigilantes that are operating with more or less explicit support from the state. And that goes back to Jim Crow and to before that to the way that the slave laws were enforced. And what we're arguing in the book is that some of these new policies have brought back that tradition of vigilantism, of private actors who are working hand in glove with the state to enforce these really restrictive policies.
Well, thank you, David, for that, defining that for us. Now, I wondered if you would give us some examples of state-sponsored vigilantism in the present day. You talk about, for instance, awarding bounties to anyone who provides information on women seeking an abortion in Texas, which is illegal, or crossing state lines. We also have examples of students being encouraged to turn in the names of teachers who are talking in class about the history of slavery or the persecution of the LGBTQ community. That's illegal, for instance, in the state of Florida. There's a longer list than that. So I wondered if you just kind of talk about this modern day vigilantism and the real world, what we are concerned about in this book.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, we spent a lot of time looking at laws that states were passing, particularly states that had sort of a MAGA-dominated legislature as well as a MAGA-friendly governor. And we broke down these policies supporting vigilantes into four different categories. You mentioned Texas SB 8, which is Texas's notorious bounty hunter regime, which uses private parties to go after abortion providers and even people who help somebody obtain an abortion. We call that courthouse vigilantism because it's taking sort of the machinery of civil litigation and using it to send a message that vigilantes should go out and in that case, go after abortion providers. You know, another category of policies that we're seeing is what we call dissenter vigilantism. This really took off during COVID when figures like Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin invited parents to flout public health rules that have been set by public health authorities. And sort of the legal trick there is to take what we used to think of as the right to opt out. You know, say you didn't want your kid to engage in, to take lessons in sex ed. You know, it used to be, you know, they'd go sit in the library while the lessons were being taught. And dissenter vigilantism gives those dissenters the ability to effectively set policy for the entire community. So where we really see this is book bans, where, right, sometimes, you know, under some of those regimes that states are enacting, just a single objection can result in books being removed from libraries in an entire school district or even in some cases an entire state. In addition to that, we have a category of laws that we call street vigilantism. That's probably the most intuitive form of vigilantism. It includes things like laws that immunize drivers for running over racial justice protesters, laws that expand the right to carry weapons in public places, and of course, pardons of individuals who commit crimes and are convicted of them, but then are pardoned usually by a governor when they're going after perceived political enemies. Then finally, we talk about electoral vigilantism, which is particularly relevant today, which is, you know, the use of all of these kinds of vigilantism to control who votes and the way that votes are counted.
That was David Knoll, professor of law at Rutgers University and co-author of the new book, Vigilante Nation: How State-Sponsored Terror Threatens Our Democracy. Learn more about the book and legal vigilantism by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since he first entered presidential politics in 2015, Donald Trump has consistently demonized immigrants. In the current 2024 election, he's placed immigrant bashing at the center of his campaign to regain the White House, with support from his vice presidential running mate, J.D. Vance. In recent months, Trump has compared immigrants of color with animals and charged that migrants have bad genes. Trump believes his targeting of America's immigrant population to generate hate and fear is an effective tool to energize his base, even more than concern about the economy. The twice-impeached former president has pledged that if elected, he'll deport some 11 million undocumented U.S. residents, many of whom are undocumented not by choice, but because the nation's immigration laws haven't been reformed since 1986. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Kika Matos, president of the National Immigration Law Center. Here she talks about the similarities and differences between Trump and Democratic presidential nominee, Vice President Kamala Harris, on the issue of immigration.
I've been doing immigration advocacy now for 22 years, and this is the first time in over two decades of doing this work that both the Democratic and the Republican Party have embraced anti-immigrant policies. It's both alarming and foolish. You know, there is a saying that this country was in part built by immigrants. That is exactly true. If you look at it from a purely economic perspective, our economy largely thrives because of immigrant labor. Undocumented immigrants pay billions in taxes every year, even though they don't benefit from programs that they pay into, including Medicare and Social Security. Immigrants pay taxes, state and local and federal taxes. Immigrants are the ones who pick our fruits and vegetables, and they work in the kitchens, in restaurants, and they're the ones that are largely in hotels making our beds. And then we have those immigrants who make significant economic contributions in Silicon Valley and the like. So if you look across the U.S. economy, you see multiple ways that immigrants make significant contributions. And immigrants are not just to be measured by their economic contributions. They contribute to the culture of our nation. They are our neighbors. They are our friends. They worship with us. Irrespective of their status, whether they're documented or undocumented, they're very much a part of our democracy and our country. And we would benefit mostly from embracing and continuing an approach that welcomes immigrants as opposed to demonizing them. The last thing I would say is that if we go down the road that Trump has paved and now the Democrats are following, we're going to see some terrible consequences, social, political, economic, and otherwise. And so it gives us pause, and we should carefully really look at the policies that both parties are advancing and asking if that's in the best interest of most Americans. And the answer would be absolutely not.
Well, when you talk about the ramifications, you know, this article I was reading was just talking about the dairy industry and how it's basically run by immigrants and a majority undocumented immigrants. It would probably collapse because it's such hard work.
Nobody wants to do it. Yes. And here's the other thing. A lot of the arguments that we hear Trump and the Republican Party making about immigrants are just not true, right? They're based on lies and they're based on demonization and criminalization of immigrants, and they're not actually factual. And that's another problem that we have facing us, right? These rampant lies about what are the most offensive ones, that they're eating our pets and they're stealing our jobs and, what is it, raping women and bringing drugs from Mexico and across the border. And the truth is that just about every economic analysis that you look at shows that immigrants are not stealing the jobs of Americans because they're largely doing jobs that Americans don't want to do anymore because they're so hard.
The border policies seem moving in a pretty similar direction, which now, of course, Trump is taking credit for. But it does seem like there's a difference when he says he's going to basically deport every undocumented worker. And even if you've been here 20 years, 30 years, he's going to go after you. They have a database and they're going to try to do mass deportations. They're going to do workplace raids and so on. Do you know what the Democrats think about that? Or are they going that far down that road?
Democrats are not going that far down the road. And quite frankly, even though both parties have embraced anti-immigrant principles, I would say it's a false equivalence to compare the immigrant platform of the Republicans and the immigrant platform of the Democrats. I'll say that Kamala Harris, when she was a senator, was very supportive of DACA recipients. She supported some pro-immigration bills. She spoke out and denounced some of the policies that Trump advanced when he was president, including the policies of separating children. She has celebrated America's immigrant heritage and called for a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants who call this country home. So there is some nuance and there are some policies that Democrats are still supporting, including pathways to legalization and support for Dreamers that Republicans denounce. Trump wants to use the military to carry out deportation, something we will challenge in court for sure, because it is unconstitutional. He wants to end birthright citizenship, right? Something else that is deeply embedded in our Constitution.
That was Kika Matos, president of the National Immigration Law Center. Find more analysis and commentary on the issue of immigration in the 2024 presidential election campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBCR in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KMWV in Salem, Oregon, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.